Good evening, everyone. This is Gordon, W2 Tango Tango Tango, and this is the Bergen Amateur Radio Association Technical Net. Stations with emergency or priority traffic, please call KQBAR at this time. Alrighty, nothing heard, that's the right answer. The Bergen Amateur Radio Association has a technical net every Thursday night on the 146-955 repeater, the 2-meter repeater of the Chestnut Ridge Radio Club, who graciously lets us use their repeater for this purpose. This net is a little different than other nets in that it is a discussion, a dialogue, if you will, a conversation about amateur radio, electronics, communication, telecommunications, computing, electricity, natural phenomena, the way we operate, the equipment we operate with, and all sorts of other goodies related to these topics. Maybe even the places and people we meet and interact, with whom we interact. It's kind of neat. So, as we have this dialogue, this conversation, we're going to need you to check in, even if you don't have a question or a comment for the net. You might ask why that is. Well, you kind of got to know who's around the table in order to engage them. So, if you don't mind, we'd like to hear from you when you check in. Roll call is given. You need not be a member of the Bergen Amateur Radio Association. You just need to have a license to operate in the 2-meter band in these here United States. We check in directly on the radio or via EchoLink. In a couple of minutes, I'll check the EchoLink and see who's there. I believe there's at least one station there based on what I heard. We'll get to that. So the EchoLink stations need not fret. I'll approach you separately. What's nice about the EchoLink is that you can check in and text me during the net if you have a comment and you're not sure how to frame it, or you want it tabled, or you want to bring it up later, or you have some sidebar, or you're not sure how to frame it. Text me underneath on the EchoLink text window. The EchoLink access is via K2 Foxtrot Juliet -L. That's Kilo 2 Foxtrot Juliet -L as in Lima. And that remote accesses the K2 ETN repeater on 10 meters. Okay, so we'll get to that in a little bit. In the meantime, we'd like to know who's here, and the way we do this in an orderly fashion, if I may, is to have you check in with your call sign, your name, and indicate whether you have a question or questions, a comment or comments, or none of the above. So we do this by call sign group so that it doesn't become a total mess. So the way we're going to do this first is tonight we're going to start with the Whiskey 2s, any station. Actually, any station whose call sign begins with Whiskey, please call K2BARW2TTT with your call sign, your name. Indicate whether you have questions, comments, both or none of the above. Over.
This is W2JEK Dot with a comment.
Good evening, Don. I got your comment posted. Any other Whiskeys?
W2CH, Ray and White Plains, good evening, Gordon and the net. None of the above.
Good evening, Ray. Any other Whiskeys? Okay, let's go to the Kilo 2s.
KC2NKU, Maryland and White Plains, and I'm feeling much better, Gordon. Thank you for asking in advance.
Marilyn, I'm glad you're doing well. Any other kilos?
K2AMI Tony, with a question.
K2EIR, with a comment.
K2AMI, with a question, and K2EIR, a comment. Very good. Anybody else with a kilo call? Alright, so forward. Well, I was talking to Howie. All right, let's see. Let's move on to the Novembers.
KD2AKP connected. KD2AKP
KP connected. KD two AKP connected. KD two AKP connected. KC two UUZ connected. KD two AKP KD two ADC disconnected. KC two UUZ timeout. KD two AKP timeout connected. KC two UUZ.
God, there were three call signs. I only got two of them. KD2AKP is in there, Nestor, and KC2UUZ. All right, so I'm going to have to leave a little more pause here. I'm a little quick on the mic here, so we'll come back to the Echo Link guys in a minute. Just, gentlemen, just hang on. All righty, how about the Alpha station? Okay, nothing heard. How about the Novembers again, please? All righty. Well, that was pretty exciting. I think there were, I counted like 11 or 12 status messages from the Echo Link. Sending around mostly two calls. I missed the third one. So let's see. I'm going to connect to it and see who's there. Stand by. Okay, I see Joe and I see Nestor. So let's do this. So KD2AKP, Nestor. Go right ahead and let us know whether you have questions or comments or then we'll do the rotation. Over.
Connected. W2TTT connected. KC2UUZ.
Okay. All right, let's try Joe. KC2UUZ. I didn't hear anything on Nestor's audio. We'll come back to him in a minute. Nestor, if you can, type me something on the text window. Joe, go ahead.
And who are you?
All right, Noel. All right, I don't know what's up to the other guys. Noel, welcome aboard. Do you have questions and comments for the net tonight?
I got 21 little questions.
You did say 21, right?
No, what?
Okay. All right, well, let's get on with it. We're going to do comments first, and then we'll do Tony's and yours. Unless other people pop in, and we'll add them to the end. So, Don, your comments, sir, K2BAR, W2TTT, go ahead.
Hey, K2BAR, and the net W2JEK. Just remind everybody that our next Barrett test session will be at our Hamfest, which will be on June 2nd, Saturday, June 2nd, 8 a.m. in the morning. I'll be there at 8 a.m. Don't wait around. Remember that the Hamfest has been moved to June the 2nd because of other events at the school. So that's about all I have here. Back to that, W2JK.
Okay, very good. That's good reminders about both the Hamfest and also the test session. Very good. In fact, Jim, K2FJ, was inquiring about GERS, one of my assistant Scott Masters and friends, as to when he was going to take his test. He will shortly. Given what he told me on Tuesday, he's ready. He just needs to take the time to go take the test. All right, anybody have any questions for Don about this? Okay, very good. Don, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
That the extra class examination will change as of July 1st. Materials that you're studying for the current exams will become obsolete and you will have to start in all over again with new questions and a whole new batch of things to study. So working on the extra class, be sure to study hard and get it in by the end of June. Back to that, W2JK.
That's a good point. The extras are changing in June. Very good. All right. Nestor apologizes for not checking in. He's having a little trouble with his connection. Going to text it. That would probably be the way it's handling it. He's got intermittent connectivity. All righty. Very good. All right. Let's let it drop, and then how are your comments, sir? D2EIR, EIR, W2TTT. Pat Howie.
Okay. Here is K2EIR, and I realize I didn't quite stick to the protocol you suggested, so let me say my name is Howie, H-O-W-I-E, and I'm in Tarrytown. And my comment is a follow-up of last week. I know I've sent Gordon several articles about linear loading and some references also to fractal antennas. And as Gordon observed last week, these are all ways of getting usually a more compact antenna than a full-sized antenna. My comment this week really is, looking at it, both of these things, linear loading and fractal antennas, seem to be putting more wire into the same space. Or in other words, they do make them more compact and more condensed, as I think Andy Pfeiffer, with his stuff on linear loaded antennas, stated there's more perimeter. It gets more perimeter wire into less physical area. Okay, so the area may be, or length may be shorter, but the amount of wire is greater, or as much as a full-size, say, dipole or whatever. I was also trying to look at the articles, and I think there isn't as much published on fractal antennas, but from what I can see, the designs are for 10 meters and 20 meters, and it looks like if we extrapolate to 40 meters, it'd be rather large, whereas the linear loaded designs seem to be smaller. So I think if I was going to build something, I'd probably pick linear loading for 40 and maybe 20, and fractal for 10 and possibly, you know, 15 or 20. So that was my comment, and I know not everybody's been reading this stuff, so it may be hard to follow it, but if you are looking for something compact, these are the two areas I would suggest. Thank you, Gordon. Long comment. W2TTT from K2EIR.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Howie, first of all, thank you for the finding the reference to a couple of things, including the 73 magazine article. I didn't have a chance to try that PDF chopping tool, but thank you for sending that along as well. They do seem to be hard to find, so I appreciate that, along with the text that you used, or that you extracted using that tool. If anyone's interested in fractal antennas, let me know, or Howie know for that matter, and we'll send you some stuff. Linear loading stuff is a kind of cool way of doing it as well, especially like the ladder line with the third wire inserted in the middle to shrink it down. That is kind of a neat approach. In any case, anybody have any comments or questions about compact antennas, whether they are fractals or any of the other techniques over here? Minor question about that. Sure, go ahead. In this month's QST, there was a nice article about the 41-foot antenna. I think LDG's selling it now, and matching and so forth. Now, I believe LDG normally uses a 4-to-1 on, I think it's a on 4-to-1. But what they were talking about was matching it with a basically coil wire at the bottom. Does the coil wire change the current distribution such that you're not really getting it as efficient an antenna? Does it move the current, the high current part down into the coil, and then you have the normal current distribution above? So, say you were trying to use it on 40 meters, where your antenna should be, well, half waves. But anyways, you know what I'm saying. It changes the distribution. Does it decrease the efficiency of the antenna by much?
My observation is, yeah, absolutely. So let's compare two things here, because you raised the issue. A base-loaded coil type vertical antenna with a nominal ground plane versus a linear-loaded element opposing a ground plane, or even a vertically mounted dipole that's linearly loaded on both sides. So let's just review what that is. You take the half-wave element and you go up one side of your ladder line, down back toward the feed point with the other, and then you go back up the middle with a third wire that you have to insert into the ladder line in order to get the extra length you need. So my question, and I'm going to throw it to Howie, is, Howie, why would I use a base-loaded vertical with counterpoise when I could use either a linearly loaded vertical that's full length RF-wise and in theory have less loss, or a vertically polarized dipole, which would also be somewhat shorter? What do you think?
Here is K2EIR. Well, I'm at a loss theoretically about the differences. I have just learned to think of coils as lossy. It's Q factors and so forth, and generally, the resistance in a coil, for example, in typical base loading, I don't know this antenna that was just referenced in a current issue of QST. I haven't looked at that. Whether it would be any different, but normally your typical base loading with a coil is lossier, presumably, than linear loading, and so that is, I believe, what the difference is. But I'm really not an expert and haven't tested and haven't tried enough. But I will say one thing from looking both at the fractals and the linear loading stuff, and it really goes back to simple truths that we learned over the years, and I realize they could be simple untruths too. And, years ago, the stuff coming out of the league would recommend for the beginner, get your antenna up as high and as long as possible. And as years went by, in the antenna books, the other thing they used to say is, well, if you can't put it up as a conventional dipole, half-wave dipole, for example, you can bend it, you can bend the ends, you can do this and that. And linear loading and fractal antennas do exactly that. They bend the antenna. And I'm using an antenna that I'm very happy with that LB Siebeck, who's deceased now, wrote up, called the inverted U. And the idea being that the first part of the antenna, as was just mentioned, has the high current and therefore radiates the most. So if you can put up a horizontal dipole, for example, and just drop wires from the ends, thus creating an inverted U, you could have it in a more compact space, a more easily handled rotatable dipole, and still get most of the efficiency of a full-size conventional dipole that would be all horizontal. I don't know if that answers the question you posed for K2EIR. Back to you.
So, I guess to go back to, the gist of what Noel was asking, and I guess by slight modification I was asking, would you think that a linearly loaded vertical element of the type I described, which is essentially half of your folded dipole, be more efficient than a base-loaded end-foot-length vertical? And my inclination is to say yes. I think your losses are going to be a lot less because you're distributing the capacitance through the system, minimizing capacitance through the system, and you're also distributing the loading through the system as opposed to spot in the base.
W2JEK.
Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, well, as I was read that you have an antenna wire, let's say a vertical, and the maximum current point is a quarter wave down from the tip of the antenna. So that means in the case of a 33-foot vertical, which is for 40 meters, the highest current is right at the base. Made that antenna 40 feet or 43 feet long. Now we raise that antenna up, raise that high current point 10 feet up off the ground, and we feed that with a series capacitor, and which is a higher impedance, so it's not as dependent on an efficient ground system as the true quarter wave. Likewise, in the same, the other is if we have an eighth wave, let's say a 33-foot vertical, about 36 ohms on impedance on 40 meters, but you get down, put that on 80 meters, you're talking with about 7 ohms of impedance. Of course, you have to match that, but you have to understand that the ground system has to be a whole lot better because now you're dealing with a 7 ohm antenna instead of a 36 ohm antenna. Of course, having it a full wavelength long, which would be a 33 foot would be a 20 meters, much of a ground behind at all, but you'd need some. Of course, again, you have to match it. Now, I did have a 40 foot vertical one time made out of a rainspout, galvanized rainspout, 7 radials underneath it. The coil went to ground, made of copper tubing. And a couple of nice switches, and we were able to either put in a series capacitor for 40 meters, which is fixed, or we could use one or two taps on the coil, one for 20 meters and one for 80 meters. That's how we had this antenna arranged. It was in the early 1950s, maybe 1958 view of QST. They have it downstairs someplace. Called the Secrets of Vertical Antennas. How they arranged it, the only problem was you had to go out in the dark night and go throw the taps when you wanted to change the band. Back to that, W2J.
Yeah, I think your points are well taken, and that's very instructive. How about anybody else's thoughts on this? Anybody have any final comments on this? Noel, let me throw it back to you. Any comments that you want to add?
Well, take a look at today's QST versus the one I just got. It was really interesting about how a 41 foot has less performance on the higher bands, like 10 and 15, and how its resonance is approximately on 60 meters. It opened my eyes to a couple things, because I was thinking about antennas for the upcoming portable day. Back to that, then, to OEO.
Go ahead,
Don.
Yeah, the thing is, well, I was probably mentioned there, yes, this is what happens. These antennas is too long for anything beyond, let's say, 20 meters. When you get on 17 meters, 15, 12, or 10 meters, now you're beyond the 5/8 wave antenna. A 20 meters, a 43 footer acts like a 5/8 wave. It has a low angle of radiation. You get the frequencies above that, you start getting the. Double extended depth for 20 meters, but once it gets onto 17 meters or 15 meters, now you start with an X pattern in your radiation. Now your radiation is like 45 or some degrees away from the antenna instead of being at right angles to it. Next pattern. And that's basically what happens with this, is you're shooting a lot of that, your energy up in the air in those high frequencies. So even though they do radiate some, getting the most out of it. So I guess that's the limitation of them. They're good. Unless you use a shorter antenna somehow. Back to net, W2JK.
Okay. Yeah, very good. That's a good point. Let me tease you a little bit, Noel. Well, it's 41 feet long. yeah, it's going to be close to, well, a little closer to 60 meters than 40. So that's kind of fun. Anyway, big deal. Let's see. I don't know if there's anything else we really want to cover here. But, for 40 and 80 and 60, I think it's a fairly decent way to go. Probably for 160, it's a little short, but, you do with what you got. I've been tempted for a long time to light up my tower and shunt feed it, but then someone warned me that I got to make sure that I isolate all the coaxes coming in here to other radios, because I'm going to throw RF into the radio, the front ends of other radios, and that would be bad. So I haven't done that. So I think what I would be inclined to do is take the approach that Howie suggested with that linearly loaded triple wire thingy, the ladder line that's been modded. You can build your own too, and there's no reason why you can't make it up, and back. Make it four passes instead of three, and there's no reason why not to make it shorter, but you can put something like that on 160. And I'd be inclined to do something like that and hang it on a slope over a ground field or even across, two elements like that. If you have room for a 40 meter dipole, consider this. If you have 67, 68 feet, there's really no reason why you couldn't do a quad span linearly loaded dipole on 160 over your little curtain. And you can build that in PVC tubing. I think it would be marvelous. Let me just throw that out there. In fact, let's say you don't have room for a 40 meter dipole, but maybe you have room for a 20. You might consider building something for, four passes or three passes to the wire that, work on 80. So, just math in your head. It's divide by two, divide by three, that kind of thing. And you're good to go. So consider that. I think it would be a marvelous antenna exercise.
Repeater. Timeout. Clear.
Oh my, was I quick or what was the problem there? Was I quick or too long?
You just timed it out for a second, I think so, Gordon. I got a comment though.
Go ahead.
Now, one thing is a collinear antenna is 10 meters. I have three 16-foot dipoles.
Wait a minute.
I have a 16-foot 10-meter dipole, or say 16 feet roughly. I have four connected with insulators on either side. In other words, the center dipole has two 8-foot legs. There is a piece of ladder line hanging down. It's about 8 feet long. Then you have another 16-foot length of dipole with it, and the ladder line hanging down, another 16-foot length, which goes to the end insulator on either side. So basically what happens is you feed this thing with open wire. On 10 meters, you've got this linear dipole on 10 meters that has a fantastic broadside, maybe about 4 dB or so of gain in the broadside pattern on 10 meters. On the other bands, the linear loading doesn't matter. It doesn't act as linear loading. It's not phasing. The phasing stubs do not, the hanging ladder line pieces are phasing stubs on 10 meters. On the other bands, they're just linear loading, so you can use this, let's say, on 80 meters or any of the other bands. You won't get the gain out of it that you would on meter band, but you would have a usable antenna on the other bands as well. Back to net, W2JK.
Katie. Yeah, okay. Good thoughts. Good thoughts. All righty. Noel? Okay. A couple different questions here. I'm at the floor. First, I have a Motorola repeater power supply. 15 amp continuous, 17 amp peak. Do you think that something like that would be in any way hazardous to use on an HF radio?
Okay, let's stick to the subject we're on just first before we go there. I was asking if you had any more on this subject, the antenna subject.
Oh, I have different antenna questions.
You said no more on this one, right?
No more on the linear loading.
Okay, so I want to go back to Howie then. Howie started this. Howie, any more from you?
I'll just mention, if you are interested in, I'm on a handy talkie now, if you're interested in 4080, 160, Andy Pfeiffer did have his birdcage antenna. The other fellows here won't know what that's like unless they read the article, but I did send that to you, Gordon, and it's meant to be used as a vertical linear loading. But that seems to me to be a proven design. Not that I would discourage you from making...
Yeah, no, I understand, Howie. Yeah, the birdcage antenna is kind of cool, too. But I was thinking if you put the event, you put the elements, you know, horizontally, I could make a dipole. That's kind of where I was going. Anywho, we will see. You know what I'm going to have to do... I think what I'm going to have to do is I think I'm going to have to try to build like a 20-meter antenna in a, maybe a, you know, if you will, a 5 or 6 meter format.
Sure.
Just to test out the theory and compare that to a 20-meter antenna, similarly positioned, et cetera, and see how that goes. Alrighty, very good. This is excellent. And I have the antenna analyzer and the ability to do all sorts of cool stuff, so... thinking that that might be something you should try out. I also have a dipole that is made of two 12-meter ham sticks with very long whips. In other words, they're longer than 12 meters would require, not quite long enough to be 15. So I could conceivably build something for, and that's rotatable, so I could conceivably do something like I was describing, like a 3-pass or a 4-pass folded dipole for 12 meters and put it on the other tower and spin them around and compare the two. That might be useful. Be a close comparison. And then if I like what I see with the, what I'll call the curtain array, you know, the folded dipole kind of thing, then what I'll do is I'll just build one for 80 or 106 or something and see how that goes. Or even 40 maybe. I always like to build yet another 40-meter antenna. Okay, well, thank you for that. Let's move on. Noel, well, first of all, before we move on to Noel's question, I did have Tony's question. I want to get Tony's before he goes to Betty Bye. K2AMI, K2BAR.
K2BAR, K2ORF.
Gotcha, Robert. Are you just checking in, or you're going to add a question to the thing later on?
Nah, Gordon, I'm just checking in, headed home. Just want to check in with you.
Thank you, Robert. Go ahead, Tony.
K2AMI. Open. Hi. I don't think we have enough time to finish my question, but Gordon, on Sunday night, you spoke, and you have spoken on other occasions, about something called, let me get the word right, an Arduino controller or something like that order. What is an Arduino? Is it something you buy in a box? Is it a computer? It sounds to me like good food. Can you give me some information where I can read and learn about this type of controller?
Absolutely. It's Arduino. It's Italian. It's an academic research group developed this little prototype board. It's got a processor on it. They have a little language on it. It's C-sharp-like language, which means that, it's not quite assembly language programming. It sort of looks like C. Not that hard, and there's plenty of pieces of code out there that you can start with and just compile them and download them into the box through a USB port. know, lights blink and things like that. Because the board has some lights on it. It's got mid ports, also with modulation ports, partly serial parallel ports galore. But let me spell this out for everybody. A-R-D-I-N-O. Arduino. R, seven letters. A-R-D-I-N-O. Just Google it and enjoy. Now, there's a lot of little Arduino controllers out there. There's a whole family of them. There's the Mega. But the Arduino Uno is the basic board, and it's pretty good. And then there's little plug-on things. What you may want to wait for, if you're looking for something that's like in the $30 range, that's actually maybe more powerful, is look for a thing called Raspberry Pi. Pi. That board is just entering production now, and all the usual places have it when they have them in stock. Right now, they're just, there's a backlog. I know I'm on two waiting lists for them. But the Raspberry Pi B board is probably the best. It's got all sorts of stuff on it. We drop it. If you want to spend a little more money and get a little something a little more modest, an Arduino controller at Radio Shack. Yes, I said it. You can buy an Arduino board at Radio Shack. If someone wants to see mine and play with it, they're welcome to get. It's got a couple of things on board that are kind of cute. You know, people do all sorts of interesting things. I mean, I have an Ethernet adapter on. We take in messages on the Ethernet and get things back out, do all sorts of little test programs like that. I've been building test probes with a couple of colleagues. In fact, one colleague liked what I had in mind. I said, why bother with a controller? In one case, I actually was doing something with my Flex, and he actually said, well, why don't I just take your design here, your software design, and just put it in a little module, run it on your PC, and we'll have it talk to the Flex via the virtual USB port, you know, your virtual serial port. So that's kind of the target. So you start with something standalone, and eventually you move to something you can embed in something else. But there's no reason why you couldn't build a rotator control box. That would be a lot nicer than, let's say, the CDE ones, Arduino controller. You really could, and it would be very simple to do. Has anyone else played with an Arduino controller or seen the Raspberry Pi? I mean, other than, I know Jim Jackson's seen it, there's both of these, but anybody else played with that stuff? All right, well, Tony, that's the start of it, and I'd be happy to give you a little demonstration one day. I mean, I can take a whole piece of code, we can make lights blink and take voltage readings and do all sorts of little things like that. Pieces of code that already exist, and you can mess with them too, over.
Gordon, hi, my computer knowledge about controllers and writing code is zero. And you're over my head already with just an explanation. But now I know something that I don't know before.
Well, consider this. You do know about electricity and electronics. So if you can build the interface, you know, then there's probably code out there or someone who can write the code. Because the code for the Arduino controller is really, really simple. So even if it's over your head, it's probably not over a lot of other people's heads. It's kind of amazingly simple.
Easy for you, difficult for me, you know. Okay, we're going ahead with other questions from Noel. We'll explore Willie Tech, the encyclopedia.
Right. So what I'd like you to do is look at the Arduino projects and don't worry about the software. Look at the interfaces and don't worry about the software. That's kind of what I'm going to suggest that you do. Because we can always find some code monkey to crank code for you. I mean, any number of us can do that in our sleep. But, you know, I think you'll find that the software is fairly straightforward, and have a good time with it if you just find what you'd like to have turned on, turned off, controlled, measured, what's the logic you want? When this does this, you want that to do that. Or I want it to do it for 10 seconds, or I want to do it for 5 seconds, or whatever. That kind of thing. So, it really is that simple. As I said, there's actually a voltmeter function built on this thing, so no reason why you couldn't build the indicator. You could spin the rotator and read the output of either the resistor bridge or something else. If it comes back with a number, all you have to do then is calibrate that number to a compass bearing. Someone else can do that code, but all you need to know is this is the left-hand button, this is the right-hand button. It would built in the automatic gliding brake, all that stuff, you know, it can be done. And you could have presets that you could type in, or, you know, have a preset for, you know, Mo, Larry, and Curly, and it would just point the antenna toward Mo, Larry, or Curly, depending on which button you pushed. Alrighty. Anybody else have any questions about microcontrollers? Alrighty. Let's see. Let's move on then. Mr. Noel, over to you. Your question was about... Actually, before I hand it to you, I'll just repeat your question. You have a Motorola power supply, 15 amps continuous, 17 amps peak, and you were wondering whether you could use it on an HF radio. Answer, yes, within the limits of the current specification. What's nice about a Motorola power supply is when they say 15 amps, they mean 15 amps probably forever. So, that's a good thing.
It is a repeater power supply.
Right, so, little math, 15 times 12, just 12. Gee, Willikers there, buddy. I think you've got a little more than Beck, but, you're not gonna run, I would think, 100 watt output radio. That's probably got close to 200 watts of power input. Might be a little tight, but it's certainly worth thinking about. You know, got 180 watts there, but, I'll bet you could probably run a 100-watt transceiver on that power supply, especially since it's got 17 watts or 17 amps of peak, and you're probably going to run a single cycle. As long as you don't try to run 100 watts of, PFQ31, I think you're fine.
I was thinking on sideband, you're only going to draw a lot of current on the peak, so I figured a capacitor across the output would take care of the sideband peaks, because I'm sure the current on an HF radio is far less than 15 amps. And by the way, it says 13.8 output, so that 13.8 times 15 amps is 207 watts.
Okay. Well, I think you've got a good thing. I mean, my gut feeling is a repeater power supply is also probably going to be very clean. It's not going to have a lot of junk on it. What you might want to do is see if you have a 100-watt transceiver that you can, let's say, start with 50 watts power output into a W. Put a scope on the power supply as you key up and unkey and hold it back. See what it looks like.
Okay, yeah, I'll get my scope back from Bruce.
That sounds like a good idea. Anybody else have thoughts?
Who am I?
Tony, you're back.
What Noel is speaking about is power supplies that I'm using right now to power this radio. This is a 25-watt two-meter radio, and it sounds clean to me from this side. I don't think you hear any additional hum except PL tones, and it's driving this radio very fine. So I think it'll work fine.
Most excellent. Okay.
I threw him in the barrel box.
Keithwood.
Yep. Okay. Well, you know what? I'll be real honest. If it came out of a barrel box, it's probably a good thing. But I would make a point of checking it out thoroughly before I put something I love on it.
They look like new. The cables, power cables, that are computer cables plug in the back, look like new. Jim Joyce said the little thing that we had on the two wires was a thermistor that you would place on the amplifier. So if the amplifier has started suffering thermal runaway or got too hot, it would shut off the power supply.
Well, that's encouraging, isn't it?
That was the first question. I was thinking just putting a capacitor on the output to get me over those little peaks, because it's a sideband peak.
Well, I'm going to be a little frank with you. You know, at 17 amps peak, at only 12 volts, you're over 200 watts. So at 13.8, you've probably plenty of headroom. That part I wouldn't worry about. I wouldn't bother with the capacitor, although they get the cheese stuff. Just, you know, try the 50 watt, put a scope on it, make sure it's all clean, check on the voltmeter, all that good stuff. As long as it's not cruddy, crank it up. Start even at 20 watts. Just, you know, give it a look.
Okay, you ready for the next question?
Fire away.
Okay. I noticed that you could build a J-pole rather easily. I was looking at... Okay, the subject is, if you're at a campground and you want to get up a frequency, in most of the campgrounds, dipoles are a little hard to do, and you usually have a space, you know, one side of the motorhome you might have 20 feet, the other side 30 feet. You don't have a lot of space, but you can go straight up, because usually... We're in the trees, and we can go straight up. So I'm thinking, you know, a 20-meter J-pole is only 48 feet.
A 40-meter J-pole is how big?
A 20-meter J-pole is only 48 feet, approximately.
Yes, that is true. That is true. And I've actually thought about that, offsetting it from my tower. And that would be an interesting thing to do. If I could find a way to get a mast that was, let's say, 50 feet or so in the air across my yard, preferably 60 feet in the air across my yard, I'd put a pulley system on my mast that would rotate on like I would take a thrust bearing and essentially hang from, you know, snap it onto my tower, not forming my mast, but use the twin collar instead of bolting it to the tower. I would let it run free so that the mast could rotate underneath it and support a horizontal wire that would be essentially a hang line for such a thing. I've thought about that J-pole, the 20-meter J-pole in the sky. I mean, what a hoot that would be, a gate vertical with no ground.
Okay, next question. It's a multiple part question. We'll start with part A. If one had, Nico had a nice little antenna with an inverted V, and I swear the peak of it looked like it was 10 feet off the ground, and he was doing really good at field day last year, and, let's see, up at the scout camp during one of our times when we had the lost scout, I think Gordon had a antenna in a tree, and it couldn't have been more than 8 or 10 feet high. And in last portable day, Don had an antenna in a tree that he was working away with, and I had a duck to get underneath it at one point of the antenna. So the question is, if you're going to set up with a dipole, and you happen to have a 15-foot height easily available, would that make a really decent NVIS antenna for 40 meters, and would it work at all, you know, decent on 20, 10, 15?
Well, I don't know about the 20 and 10 and 15, but I do know that at 40 meters, it works outstandingly well. My guess is if 10 is open, or 15 is open, 15 feet is probably okay. 20 meters, again, if it's open, it's open, but, you know, a little goofier. But, and this antenna is a wonderful thing, 15 feet, absolutely. My 40-meter Invis antenna is probably not even 15 feet in the middle, and barely clears the garage, and one end is barely off the ground, and the other end is on an 8-foot or 10, I guess a 10-foot pole. So, you know, it's, and one end is bent, too, for that matter, the one end, the end that barely is off the ground is bent in a couple of odd directions. Works fine.
W2JK.
Go ahead, Doc.
One thing I used to do lunchtime is go down to the park in Hackensack by the Hackensack River, Fashini Park. And I had a 2-meter ground plane mounted in the door frame of my car. And what I did is I had a 33-foot piece of wire with an alligator clip hooked onto that base at the bottom of this 2-meter vertical that I had there. Connected the 2-meter ground plane's antenna, the coax, to my Heathkit HW8, ran this wire out horizontally to a tree up near the riverbank, say about 4 or 5 feet off the ground maybe. I worked into Canada, Virginia, and Mexico, Michigan with this thing on 40 meters. Another time I was out at Arizona where my daughter lives, and I had an antenna about 8 feet off the ground. I used it mainly on 20 meters. I went coast to coast. It was only about 8 feet off the ground because we're in one of these homeowner association places with all kinds of rules. So I didn't want to provoke anything. So I had the antenna started out on a porch roof, and one end of it went over a tile roof, and the other end went out to a tree, which is about 6 feet off the ground. Basically, it was a 40-meter dipole, but in the halfway marks, they had insulators with alligator clips, so I could make it into a 20-meter dipole. Those things do work, and don't be afraid. They will get out, believe it or not. Back to net.
Okie doke. That's good information. Anybody else? Okay, Don, thank you very much. Did you want to add any more?
Well, the last question.
Well, I was asking Don, does he want to add any more?
I was using about 2 watts of QRP on CW. I guess that's the only other thing I could add to it. I have pictures of that operation. I should bring them in sometime. Back to that. W2JK.
Outstanding. Thank you, Don. Yes, Noel. Go ahead.
Last part. Some people feel an off-fed dipole is very useful. But if you're going to be, you know, 10 feet off the ground, would a fan dipole be more balanced and easier to work with than the complex impedances that would be found in an off-fed dipole, say a 40-meter one that would be meant to work almost all the bands?
I'm not getting that. I'm sorry. Try that again.
Okay. Some people use off-fed dipoles because one advantage, of course, is you can feed it near one end. But depending on who you believe, anywhere is from 10% to 20 to 30%, 28%. Anyways, it's sometimes useful if you have one end that can be higher in the air and the other end not. But if you were going to use one in woods or whatever where you're not going to be high off the ground, would you go with an off-fed dipole, or would you prefer like a fan dipole?
Well, I've done a 40-20 fan dipole using, I think, twin lead, and with good results. And they were, it was in an endless configuration in my backyard. So a lot of stuff higher than it all around, too. So I'm thinking that I would use that, but I'll throw it on the floor. Anybody else?
B2JEK.
Don?
Yeah, when my father was alive, he put out the 46-foot, or so-called 50-foot push-up mast in the backyard, and he was had a pair of inverted Ds on there, one for 80 and one for 40, and then he started playing with traps. And those things, depending on the length of the antenna and the angle and everything else, and you're going to have to do a lot of adjusting with that. I know I have a friend out in Pennsylvania has one. I have a couple of them, and they work great. But they're not moving around all the time. They're not a portable thing, and he probably has adjusted them to where they. But that's the whole thing. Some of these things require a lot of trimming and pruning. I think that the fan dipole might be in that category, because if you affect, do something on the one antenna, it's going to affect the other. Whereas if you have something that you can feed with an open wire and a tuner, you don't have all that problem. You just sit down and crank the tuner, and or if your automatic tuner will handle it even better. You don't have to worry about all this pruning and everything, because that could be rather strenuous if you've got to put the antenna up and down and up and down a whole lot. It takes away from your operating time. Back to net, W2JK.
Okay. Very good. Very good. That's useful to know. Noel, does that answer your question?
Well, I'm thinking an off-fed dipole fed with the TS-50 with the AT-50 built into it would probably, I guess it has a range of what, 10 or 20 ohms to a few hundred ohms? So it may handle that. If you get it, the off-fed dipole in the backyard, say they do it at 10 feet, and you take it in woods and you start threatening, you know, there's some trees nearby, I'm wondering if the tuner would be able to handle that.
Don't know, but you got a great good point. I mean, I don't think I'd put an OCF in low. I think that's kind of my thought in general. But you could. An OCF as an endless antenna, that sounds intriguing, but I've never even given it much thought. So here's a suggestion. Has anyone actually tried to model any of the antennas that we're talking about here tonight? Or are we just kind of like back to the old empirical method and go, oh, I guess it works good? I mean, you know, maybe it's time for someone to run out easy neck on this stuff.
Huh? I never tried any of this modeling stuff, but I always think this way. You're faced with certain restrictions here. In my case, I got room just enough for from the chimney on my house to the tree in the backyard, I got about maybe 70 feet, so I've got a 40-meter dipole strung between the two. You know, that's what I'm dealing with. And I have an infrared wire that goes up from the cellar window, goes up to the rain gutter, out across the yard, and then from there it goes to that sanctuary, and then it goes below the dipole, and then makes a turn, and another 30 feet goes off to the west. Now, all these wires, no, they're there, and put them up, and you know, you'd be surprised at what you get on. And if you have a the best thing I'd just say is to put the thing up and put it up at 5 feet or 10 feet off the ground, see how it works, you know, and or try it at different heights. It's the only way you're really going to find out. You may be able to simulate something with an easy neck, but. Then again, is that going to be your situation? You're putting in something what you think might be normal ground, but your ground might not be normal. You know, that kind of thing.
Exactly. I think that's a good point. I mean, a lot of this is based on just the practical realities of your geometry of your lot, what you can get away with, and what band you want to try to get on. So you try to put up as efficient an antenna that's going to throw RF in the direction that you want as best as possible.